time opening.
We have an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity.
Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Welcome, everybody, to Anatomy of a Movie. Today we are talking about DreamWorks animated film, How to Train Your Dragon 2.
Yeah!
Yes. I'm your host, Marissa Serafini, and with me I have...
Hi, guys. It's Sarah Stratton.
Hey, movie fans. Dimitri Panos.
Dimitri's back.
He's back.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening. Okay. What did we think of the sequel? Did it live up to your expectations, or did it not?
Ooh. I think that I want to say that I really enjoyed this movie. I love this, I guess, franchise. Mm-hmm. The first How to Train Your Dragon was one of my favorite animated movies of all time. I absolutely love it. I own it. I watch it probably more times than I should every year.
Like,
but so I had really, really high expectations. And I found myself being a little bit hypercritical during the first couple of scenes. Like, I was smiling crazy when they did that big dramatic flight scene in the beginning, and they had the dragon in the clouds, and like I had this huge grin on my face. But then as soon as kind of the more talking, conversational scenes started happening, I did find myself overanalyzing. So I had to kind of like be like, remember to just kind of imagine and let it be free and stop thinking so much. But overall, I was very happy. It was very hard to let go of all the expectations I had built up, though.
Okay.
Interesting. This movie pleasantly surprised me. It's for me, personally, it's very tough to make an animated sequel and make it work. In my humble opinion, for whatever I know, for whatever it's worth, you know, there's only been a few. Like, you know, to me, the Toy Story trilogy is, if you're going to talk about animated, that's the best animated trilogy you're going to find. I mean, near perfect screenplays on each one, story-wise. Hard to compare to that. And there's been a couple of other animated sequels that have been okay. But for the most part, you know, you can get burned because it's a money grab. And, you know, I'll go back to Pixar. Cars 2, to me, was a very big disappointment. I'm such a huge fan of Cars. So going into this one, I didn't quite... You know, I went in with not a huge expectation. I most certainly enjoyed the first movie. I thought they created a fantastic world, and it was fun, and it had a good story to it. And ultimately, that's what it comes down to. You need a good story. And then as I was watching this movie, I found myself, like, pleasantly surprised, and I was grinning, and I was like, you know, in the end, I can nitpick certain things, but there were certain plot points that, yeah, I get it. This is going to move the story this way. But I found that the story, its message, I really, like, you know, I ended up enjoying it. And I said, you know, they came up with a good story. And looking for what we have coming up to the, you know, for the rest of the year, like, this could potentially be nominated for Best Animated Feature because, well, absolutely, we don't have a Disney movie this year. We don't have a Pixar movie this year. So this one right now, for me, is standing out. I think it's... I think it's a solid film.
I agree. Solid. I mean, I was a huge fan of the first one when it came out in 2010. How to Train Your Dragon 1 was actually my first 3D film that I saw in theaters.
Oh.
So I really enjoyed the experience. It was more enhanced the first time I saw the first movie, so I loved it from the beginning. And then, you know, you mentioned Toy Story and that franchise. I actually, because Toy Story 3 and How to Train Your Dragon came out in the same year, different times of the year, but it was like the same time. And I actually thought How to Train Your Dragon was better than Toy Story 3. I mean, hate me.
Blasphemy, I do.
I know. But that was my personal opinion. I thought, you know, Toy Story 3 at that point was a bit overhyped and a bit overrated. And Toy Story, they're great films. I love them too. But I thought How to Train Your Dragon was so original and it was new. It was a new animated franchise that kids can latch on to, and also the adults too, because we love pets, and then having dragons you know, portray anything of a cat, dog-like characteristics, we're going to, you know, admire that. And that's always fun to watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I have to pick a side between Toy Story and How to Train Your Dragon, I'm going to pick How to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah, you're both out of your minds.
Me too. I mean,
From a screenplay. But doesn't mean I love you less.
Toy Story is a great franchise. No, I'm not saying I disliked it, but I really did enjoy How to Train Your Dragon, especially being original. And Toy Story has already been out for 10 years, and then having something new and fresh to animation, I really appealed to that. Yeah.
No, the first How to Train Your Dragon for me was a very nice, pleasant surprise. I didn't... you know, I had heard, I mean, it was getting good reviews, it was getting very goodwill, and, you know, when I saw it, I was impressed, and it looked great. You know, it wasn't my first 3D movie. my first 3D movie in theaters is something called Coming Atcha. Yeah, look it up. But in any case, you know, it looked great, but, you know, and part of the reason, too, is, you know, we'll talk about them a little bit later, but they had, you know, they brought aboard Roger Deakins as a cinematographer. This guy's worked with the Coen brothers and such. I mean, he's a great cinematographer, and they brought him on to consult because they were filming in 3D. And so that's, you know, the movie just looked amazing, and it did really well. Unfortunately for How to Train Your Dragon, that first one was coming out at a time too when 3D was sort of kind of getting a bashing, where not every movie was, you know, really good at 3D. But I think How to Train Your Dragon was very good in 3D, and I will say I did see How to Train Your Dragon 2 in 3D, and again, beautiful. Like, I would recommend the upcharge ticket price, because I thought it looked fantastic. Amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I love this movie so much, I want to go back and see it in 3D. But I want to talk a little bit of just the beginning of remaking the second one, because when they made the first one, it was about a month after its release that they were already in talks to make a second one, and then they jumped at that opportunity. And the director, Dean DeBlois.
Yeah.
I'm going to butcher his name. We'll call him Dean for the sake of
thanks, Dean.
Dean, the director, he mentioned that if he was going to do a sequel, it should be in a trilogy-like setting. Mm-hmm. That the first one, the three parts of his story.
Sure.
And just to justify doing a sequel, because a lot of people know sequels may not always live up to the first one. And so he says if he wants to do it, it has to be part two of, you know, part threes.
Right.
So, and I liked how he approached that, and how everyone was still back on board for the second one.
I agree, and I think it's very gutsy. It's a gutsy proposition to say, you know, especially in today's, you know, they did have a phenomenal success with How to Train Your Dragon, the first one, globally. Yeah, it did around 500 million worldwide. That's, you know, that's a lot of spondulics right there. So you can make a sequel, but still, to make a sequel to an animated feature, it's still a risky proposition. And and for a director to say, I'll only be involved if we make this a trilogy, because
if we make two more films,
we got to make two more. And, you know, for a studio to say, you know, and again, we can look back. It's sort of kind of fascinating, because the first How to Train Your Dragon, if I'm correct, was released via Paramount Pictures. That's who DreamWorks had their distribution deal with. And now a lot's changed. Their distribution deal now is with 20th Century Fox. Things have changed since then, but for Fox to say, or Katzenberg, who oversees and goes, okay, you know what? I have enough faith in you that you, okay, you're good to go with two more movies, and we'll see where that gets us. But, yes, I greenlight a trilogy. That's gutsy.
That's very gutsy, especially for so long ago already, because you don't know how well the first one's gonna track yet, and how well the second one might even track. Let alone at third.
Right.
So that says a lot of faith in Dean as a director.
Absolutely.
And the story and the content that they're writing with.
Absolutely. You know, couldn't agree more. So, you know, and I think for this one being his middle story, we were talking just before we hit action that, and, you know, he's a big Star Wars fan, and his favorite movie, the one that as a kid really affected him, was Empire Strikes Back. And, you know, this one, I see. Yeah, Empire Strikes Back's a great film, but I would argue too that it's not a complete movie. This one, to me, I think this one was a more complete movie. Empire leaves us on a cliffhanger, right?
You're expecting another one.
Well, but Han Solo's in carbonite somewhere.
You have to go get him.
Luke Skywalker just found out that Darth Vader's his dad. He's got to cope with that, and the movie just ends. Mm-hmm. This movie did have a clear ending. But knowing that, okay, so how are we going to deal with Hiccup now that he's chief? So you could see that when they go ahead to make the third, where progression can go. But as this was a self-contained movie that had a beginning, a middle, and an end, you know?
Completely. And so I agree with you where it's a little bit different. To me, they've all been kind of standalone, and third's preparing itself to be a standalone. Which is good to bring in new audiences, and it's good so that it really does open it up. But I don't know. It's like, for me, searching for that next chapter, there are windows, there are little indications. There's no big, I guess, in a way, overarching problem like there is in Star Wars.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there isn't the cliff. Like, we weren't left on How to Train Your Dragon with, say, loose threads. If, for whatever silly reason... they don't make the third for whatever, you know, we don't know what the hands of fate will say. This one is self-contained. Like, there's no, it answered all of the questions that it raised throughout, and it didn't really leave many threads. Like, you can move forward from where our characters are.
Absolutely.
But there were no questions. Like,
and the great thing about this, the sequel, that all the characters, well, mostly, especially Hiccup, definitely had a character arc.
Oh, absolutely.
You saw it from the beginning to the end of this film. Yeah. And that's what helped make it a standalone, because he did have the full arc. And then you can go from there afterwards for the third one. And I loved just the testament of the writing and how they decided to start the sequel off 5 years later, because he's now 20 years old. They have confirmed he's 20. So he's in that awkward stage of, you know, becoming an adult, but he doesn't really want to because he still has that youthful side to him. He has his freedom. He's content with his life and just going off to different places of the world and exploring and having that freedom. But trying, and, you know, his father's stoic. And I like the relationship now in this film. I mean, it is still a bit here and there, but they have better mutual understanding of each other.
Sure.
And respect.
Yeah.
And so to see Hiccup now fighting off, you know, avoiding life things that he has to grow up in that way, I liked how that was a storyline that they can play with.
Yeah, I agree. And... you know, I mean, plus the 5 years makes sense, because I think, wasn't it about 4 years ago?
2010, yeah. Right. It's
been 4 years. So 5 years makes sense. I think for me, one of the great things about this movie and Hiccup's character arc, too, is that he loses. Like, he, you know, I mean, he goes off. He goes off thinking he can change the world.
He thinks he's found himself at 20 as being this... peacekeeper.
Right. And
that's how he identifies himself.
Yeah.
He was already a different character, because in the first one, everyone didn't like him. He was that outcast.
He was the outcast.
And now he's the town hero.
Right. And, you know, but he was also, he you know, placed this burden that he could do anything. Like, he, you know, and I can fix this. I can make peace. I can convince so-and-so. I can do this. And, you know, there was a lot of and what I liked about it is that he learns, you know, he learns, and he earned it. He earned his stripes. But, okay, maybe I can't do this, but I know what I'm good at, but I know I need support of friends, family, whatever. It's a very great message to send if people are paying attention, and the kids, like, it's a very good message. So even if you're a young kid, you can watch it a little bit later on as a teenager. You might get something else out of it. If you watch it as an adult, you go, wow, that's actually sort of kind of clever how Dean wrote that in. And he really gave – he didn't cheat his characters out in the sequel. And he gave them good heft and weight. And he did a good job. And I think that's – again, as I was watching the movie, I was like going – good job. Like, it's this sort of kind of reminds me of what a good Pixar movie should be. Like, you have to start off with the story, and once that happens, your characters fill out that story and you buy into it. So,
yeah, one of my favorite things they did with the characters, and this is going to go back to what Misha was saying about Stoic and Hiccup's relationship, where you do feel like there is this big change of, like, he does respect him, he does love him, he has built up all these expectations, but you still do get that classic problem in the first one, where they still have a problem listening to each other.
Right.
Absolutely.
So it's almost like, yeah, their hearts have opened up, their relationships have changed, but they still are horrible communicators. It just works slightly differently. Right. Like, they still cut off each other's sentences. They still constantly are dealing with this battle of, I need to tell you something, and not listening, and backwards and forth. So I like that it wasn't just completely changed and everything was all better. Right. They still were working on their relationship. I like that, the hints they would throw to the original.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And also, I loved how, you know, they played off with Hiccup's still trying to find himself, because when you're a young adult, you're still trying to have that self-awareness of who you are and who you want to be in life. And then to bring the mother character in, because, of course, we have, I mean, I think Disney has really hit it over the head with us that, you know, the main characters don't really have both parents. And this is DreamWorks. And we had in the first one that, where was the mother? And then I loved how they did bring the mother into this story. And to add another layer to Hiccup, and might have the audience understand him better, that maybe his dragon whispering side did come from his mother. Maybe it was an inherited trait.
Yeah, I mean, it totally, I mean, I took it as that's a complete hereditary. Now you know where he gets it from.
Yeah.
Now
we can understand it, but.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, I do think that it was more than that. He was trying to, as much as he thought he was the peacekeeper, he was still trying to find his full self. And his mother represented one part of, maybe, I don't think it actually was a being good with dragons characteristics. It was more of the need for freedom, need for kind of that ability to not just see everything by the rules, but look for other options. Right. And, like, that was the genetic trait that I thought that they shared, was really that, like, embracing of being free, of adventure, and of, you know, not wanting to just completely step in line and follow, and that willingness to speak up. That's what I thought he got from her. And I liked that it wasn't just like, oh, these two people are just magically skilled with dragons.
Yeah.
It was more based on, like, a heart thing than, like, oh.
Absolutely. It wasn't a magic. Yeah, it wasn't midichlorians.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't like, we have a special bond. It was like, both of them, in their own separate way,
correct,
earned it, and it came from their both this desire for freedom, for looking for sign of ways to change things.
And I think it was also the vision of having the bigger picture and looking at everything instead of the one negative thing, that maybe these dragons are more like us and we don't realize it, and having the option to be more open to something that you might be afraid of up front, because these dragons are big and scary, but that doesn't mean that they don't have feelings, that we can't, you know, emotionally get attached to them and, you know, have that empathy for these type of characters as well.
Yeah, and, you know, we'll all go back to the mother once again, because, again, I like the fact that they bring her in. This is where my story sense of the movie sort of kind of, I was having sort of kind of issues with, you know.
With the mother?
Well, yeah, because.
Vodka?
Yeah, vodka.
Vodka.
You know, I just felt that, I don't know how they were going to broach it in this, but it was almost, there was almost too much easy acceptance, because she abandoned them. I mean, she abandoned her baby, and, you know, and she was thought to be dead, and she never came back. And, you know, from the father's standpoint too, it's like, you've been alive all this. I didn't find that was truly the human emotional beat response to that.
Yeah.
So that's my nitpick of the movie. Everything works out, and it's not that I didn't buy the relationship. I just felt like, Jesus, you pretty much hightailed it out of here, and you never came back, and you abandoned me with this son. I tried to raise him as best as I could, and now you're coming in, you're filling his mind up with whatever and doing this, and, you know, there was none of that. And for good or for bad, I just felt something should have been in there.
I agree with you. And I think that what pointed out most to me is that I had to go in this movie really prepared that we were going to meet her.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that a lot with advertising. Like, all the advertising was like, oh, your mother?
It wasn't a surprise.
Like, exactly. Yeah. And I kept thinking, I was like, if I had gone into this movie thinking that it was more about, you know, this dragon army, mm-hmm. and about him finding his mom, I would have been shocked.
Yeah.
I would have been like, what? I thought, like, it would have been so confusing, and it wasn't completely supported. So I felt like they had to, like, feed us that through advertising to kind of fill those holes, to get us so prepared, because it's kind of off the wall. Like, it was a very, in a way, open hole from the first movie where they didn't exactly clarify.
Right.
So they did have the chance to expand upon that. But at the same time, it was rushed in a way.
Yeah, there was just never
they had to rush all the encounters.
I don't necessarily buy, I haven't seen you in 20 years and you're just as beautiful as the day you walked out in my life. Mm-hmm. I was expecting a little more there. That said.
That's understandable. Also, just to touch a little bit, because also we see Hiccup's reaction, and he was very open to it, and it might be because he was also an actor, still trying to find that acceptance from everyone that, mm-hmm. you know, who he is.
Sure.
And then also, but being a 20-year-old guy, good chances you're going to probably respond upset and angry, but this is a kids type of movie. And I think, you know, going off with an angry reaction wouldn't set well mm-hmm. with the audience that is actually watching it.
And instead, so they just made her remorseful. That's what they did. They took the tactic of, okay, well, if they're not going to be angry, then we need to make her sad.
Feel bad.
I do think that they did that well.
Yeah.
I do think that, especially when she was with Stoic, like, they did try and put the sense of shame. They mm-hmm. did do, the, like, the whole flinchy thing and her not being used to it, not really knowing what to do, and the consistent, like, apologies. So I did appreciate that they put forth that effort. Like, okay, well, at least we have to show that this is an effective thing and they can't just all be one happy family together, because that would have driven me crazy.
Yeah.
Like, if she was just, like, happy about it,
sure,
then you would have been like, this is not realistic. Yeah. You would have gone back. But at least that there was some sort of shame, I was willing to give them a little bit.
I agree.
Remorse.
Like,
there.
And again, it wasn't anything that kept me from liking the movie as much as I did. I just felt that it was something missing that was actually never brought up at all.
Mm-hmm.
There are other aspects of relationship between parents and you know, son and father and mother, mm-hmm. and, you know, which I enjoyed. And then of course, you know, the other thing that the marketing put forth too is that, and again, we could talk about marketing in a bit, but it said that this movie was going to be a little bit of a different experience than the first one. And they really, you know, I mean, I knew going into this movie, they said, you know, I had read about it, and this is darker than the first movie. This has thematically, it's heavier than the first movie and whatever. And
it hit emotional beats harder, especially for maybe, because the characters are growing up, that the people who are watching are also growing up and can handle.
Yeah,
it.
But I was really expecting, like, dark. Like,
but it wasn't really dark.
Well, but I was waiting for this to happen. I was like, so far, I don't understand what people are saying, and I don't understand why they would think this could keep people away. But then the third act happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, when the father gets killed, mm-hmm. and he gets killed by Toothless. And, you know, I was like, oof, okay, this is where it gets dark. But here was my thing. I was like, okay, really? Like, are we so sensitive, like, that we're really calling this dark? I mean, because Bambi's mother gets killed right mm-hmm. at the beginning of Bambi. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have seen dark in animated movies. Look what happens in Aladdin. Like, dark things happen in animated movies. It's not that we, you know, to me, I was like, okay, if this is what they're calling dark, then maybe some people have become way too sensitive. Like, you know, not every movie can be like a Madagascar.
Right.
You know, it's,
it was literally the scene from Tarzan.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
Tarzan, yeah. when he, like, finally accepts him. And
Lion
he, like,
King, too.
Yeah. And, yeah, but, like, the dad, exactly. Right. They accept their kid and they get pushed out of the way. And I was like, we have seen that. I thought there was a really dark moment in the first movie. In the original How to Train Your Dragon, I thought that it was quite a statement to have the dad in a way be so, have Stoic be so repulsed by his son and basically say, you're not my kid for a while.
Oh, yeah.
And lock him in the house. That to me mm-hmm. was almost in a way more dark, to have this like abandonment of your child sure. and this disowning than the sacrifice that happened. Yes, it was Toothless who did it, but there was the whole excuse of it, yeah, the non knowing. And if I had to give any darkness points, it would be to the fact that they had an actual villain this time that was just unstable, I guess.
Like, yeah, no, that's a great way to... Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, he obviously had such a deranged life that his view on the world was completely
hatred,
skewed.
Yeah, twisted. And he was not going
to yeah,
change.
So
yeah,
so that, to me, was very dark. That he was just an immovable thing that had no empathy or feeling for, like, his turn away from Stoic's death, just like, oh, well, yeah. you instead of him. Yeah. I'm not too, yeah. that was more dark yeah. than actually the action.
Well, but, you know, and go ahead.
Oh, and I will give it to the writing because, yes, we saw in the trailer marketing that, like, we had Stoic's mother, Vaka, was a big character that we were expected to see. But in the trailers, I really didn't see this dark force coming mm-hmm. and it building this dragon army. I didn't get any of that from the trailer, so that was a nice surprise for me. And I will give it to the writing to add mm-hmm. that to the story as well, that we now have a big enemy. We mm-hmm. have to face him, and mm-hmm. they're using the dragons, because right now the audience has grown to love dragons and love mm-hmm. who they are and love the right. company, and now using dragons mm-hmm. in a dark way
yeah.
was another nice yeah. dark
mm-hmm.
story to go off.
Yeah, and I think, again, and I have some things about Dean talking about what he considers it being dark or not, but, you know, I mean, the word, it may not have been highlighted so much, I didn't know that anybody was necessarily going to die in the movie, mm-hmm. Perhaps it was after the con screening that reviews had come out saying this one plays it a little bit more mature than the first one, which makes sense because our characters are growing, you know. But Dean talks about, like, the conflict, let's say, or call it in the third act, and he's like, yeah, there was some concern that we'd push it until it broke, but for me, conceptually, and this is what I find interesting, I thought Hiccup and Toothless are that core relationship of the whole trilogy, and he's still talking as mm-hmm. a trilogy, and we start with them being inseparable, bulletproof, symbiotic, and the best of friends. And to me, narratively, like, how do you introduce, there's got to be a conflict, and I have to make it extreme. And we pursued that to the gutsiest extreme, but the challenge of making it sympathetic, and then he had another challenge. I mean, Toothless is the one that does it. So
you're talking about the opposite of this being them becoming, instead of inseparable friends, his choice
was some
enemies.
And mm-hmm. instead of just, like, it's not just like breaking up, Like a romantic comedy. They get together, they break up, they get back together. Toothless fell to the dark side, let's just say, if we're going to use the Star Wars metaphor or analogy.
Against his will, too. Which was unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is an extreme. But to his point, he said, this is what... It was, I had to be that extreme because this is how, when he snaps out of it, we know there's sympathy. You need to. Mm-hmm. We still have to like Toothless.
Yeah.
You know, we can't hate him. And as bad of a thing that he did, we have to be sympathetic to that. It wasn't him doing it. And I think they accomplished it.
Especially in the actual animation of Toothless after he snaps out of it. That very tentative, like, coming up and probing and I thought that was done so well. Yeah.
So I got more worked up in this film than, honestly, Fault in Our Stars, which is another film.
I completely agree with you.
Thank you. Like, I got more worked up in this animated film than that one.
Fair enough. I will completely stand by that.
Thank you.
And it was this point earlier with Stoic.
Well, you know, and again, you do feel when Toothless is chased off, like, again, and this is where Dean's writing succeeds, is that we do feel sorry for him. And mm-hmm. But at the same time, you understand Hiccup's anger.
You understand both of them.
You know, so you get it. And then it's how do you resolve this? How do you, you know, Hiccup has to mature a little more, perhaps, or, you know, how do you resolve it? So this is a movie beat for beat when you're introducing conflict. You know, any great screenwriting manual will tell you, you got to introduce conflict. And then it's about how do I resolve that conflict and then come up with the other conflict to keep my story going forward? And Dean does this in an animated movie quite well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Probably better than a lot of live action movies.
Mm-hmm. And also that it adds to Stoic's character arc because mm-hmm. now he is literally forced into the position to take on the leadership role
sure.
and turn everything around mm-hmm. and being that leader, that reluctant leader, I guess you can say, to overcome such a sad thing that happened, you know, losing his father. So mm-hmm. he has to be the leader in yeah. all that. But I did like the story of even giving the dragons more story, that now there's the alpha dragons. Because we saw in the first one, the queen bee dragon, which, you know, queen bees have the control over their hive.
Their nest.
Sure.
Yeah.
Their nest. And then we also, I like the bureaucratic system of the dragons, that there's even a higher level that we didn't think of, the alphas.
Right.
And I thought that was really an interesting story.
I thought it was great. It threw me off for a split second because I was literally like, wait. Before they introduced the other alpha, the mm-hmm. more, I guess, Leviathan alpha,
mm-hmm.
I thought that perhaps the queen bee had also been an alpha. So I was a little confused until they introduced the second, and they obviously have a very similar look besides their coloring. And right. so I was a little confused for all, because I was like, oh, had Toothless already been under the control of an alpha? And then they kind of did. They separated it even more. And I thought that was really fun to expand their world and to make, you know, have its own rules.
Yeah. It was a nice little, as you said, it's a development, it's a growth. We learn a little bit mm-hmm. more about dragon lore in this world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not 100% sure that same rules apply to, say, the Targaryen dragons.
No.
You know, but in this world, I mean, it makes, you know, this makes sense. And it's just another level of conflict mm-hmm. that, you know, our heroes have to overcome. And mm-hmm. what is the next line of, quote unquote, alpha? So.
Yeah, and it was the use of the different alphas, because we yeah. had the alpha at the oasis where yeah. all the dragons are being saved, that dragon used its power for good. You know,
absolutely.
It was,
fed
it was,
them.
Yes, it was protection, and he looked out for his own dragons. Yeah. And then we had the other alpha that used his power for bad and affected all the dragons in a negative way.
Yeah.
And it was, I loved how they showed the difference
mm-hmm.
of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was very creative. And to just add another layer to dragons to make that, they're really badass.
Yeah. No, it does create another level. And then, of course, with the ending that we get, you know, I mean, Hiccup or Toothless has his own arc as well, because he is now effectively the alpha.
Yes.
I mean, alpha, so, yes. you know, and, you know, and we know just from Toothless's character from the last movie and this one that he will be more of the nurturing, you know, he has earned the respect of not only his human Viking counterparts, but his dragon brethren. So, mm-hmm. but it makes sense.
Yeah, the loyalty of a dragon is like no other.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I thought that was cool because they are animals, mm-hmm. but being going off of the animalistic instinct, the leader of his pack.
Sure.
And that's exactly what Toothless was like. And I loved how we even expanded on his character, that he had back scales that no one knew of, and that helped.
And then they glowed.
And then he glowed. And, well, to, you know, maybe it was that Super Saiyan kind of thing, you know, go into his super extreme mode when he really does have to protect. And just him elevating as a character, giving him yeah. those more personalities
yeah.
to the dragon-like.
Yeah, he went a little Godzilla in the other alpha's ass, so to speak, you know.
Really, absolutely.
With his atomic thing. But, yeah, no, and again, with his ridges in the back popping mm-hmm. up and... Mm-hmm. Again, it's one of those, again, when you're plotting, how do I come up with these various things so that I can come back to? So, you know, at the very beginning of the movie when he's trying to fly, mm-hmm. sans toothless, and you know,
he has
he's trying
a special
to do that.
Gliding.
He's got his
one now.
Yeah, what do they call that?
Wingsuit.
Wingsuit. You know, he has his wingsuit, and you know, mm-hmm. but something's just missing. They can't make a turn, and then we know that by the end, they're going to be able as a team. Work it out, and mm-hmm. it's
yeah,
from
they,
arc.
They so. Did that twice and tried to make sharp turns, yes. and they weren't successful. Yeah. And then when he has the back,
when he has to
find
yeah.
the back ridges, you knew it was going
to
happen.
And on top of that, for it to be very visually similar to the first one, where he also is avoiding the giant tail, and that's the point where it comes into play. It was a callback to the original.
Absolutely.
To me, it reminded me of like Pokemon, like how they have like levels. Like, do you know what I mean? I was like, oh, it's toothless.
Yes.
And his levels were like Pokemon stages. It was great. I really liked it.
No, I totally agree.
Pikachu, bless you. What?
And also, a funny thing you mentioned about the bird suit, that some of the actual animators on the animation staff, they actually parachuted in wingsuit outfits just to understand the movement
the
of
dynamics.
The body.
Yeah,
yeah
right.
And how they,
yeah.
how the body moves with the wings.
Yeah.
And also for the
they
lighting.
Can't just, like, watch the thousands fight. Of videos about that.
No, of course.
Yeah.
They had
to do it.
They had
and
experience
they got paid
for work.
So. It's research.
I mean, that's terrible work. No,
the fact that they didn't have to pay,
for
you know,
me,
like
that
the
would
thousands
be terrifying
of
work. I would
that's
be
my
like,
dream.
Yeah.
And I've always wanted to go in a wingsuit.
All right, sweet.
I mean, you could go super fast in those. And also, it was to help a...
the flying the traditional way on
to,
a plane.
For them to realize like how the sunlight hits the body and like,
right.
the lighting aspect of that. I thought that was pretty neat.
Yeah. Now, you know, you mentioned look of the film. I can't... You know, I'm going to bring this up because maybe I could have been the only one in the theater. I could be the only person. I just ever... The influence that Avatar, I feel, has had on cinema.
Oh, that's my microphone. I was like, yes!
You know, has just been insane what James Cameron has influenced. Like, because I couldn't help but think.
The Dragon
of,
Sanctuary?
Yeah, the Dragon Sanctuary, the way people flew the dragons, the multicolored dragons, the multi-winged dragons, all the different looks, the way that the sanctuary looked. And I'm like, going, God, you know. Our cinematic view has so much, like, look, whether you love it or hate it, and I did not hate it in How to Train Your Dragon 2. I mean, it looked beautiful.
I want to ride a dragon.
Yeah, and
who
it
doesn't?
Looked beautiful. But to me, I just found a huge influence over Cameron's Avatar mm-hmm. in watching this, and especially even the way the dragon, there were scenes like the way the dragons.
When they swooped down along the right hand side of that one pillar ridge, I was like,
yeah.
Whoa. Seen this shot before.
Yeah. But again, hey, if you're going to you know, do it good, do it well, and, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that the inspiration is obviously there.
Yeah.
Colors were even there.
Oh, my God. The color. Yeah. That's what
it,
yeah.
But
yeah.
It was
amazing.
The fact that they did it, and like, it was a callback to me, but I was like, oh, but they do have their own little spin on it.
Absolutely.
And they've kind of embraced it into their artistic form. And I was like, and it looks good.
Yeah.
So you can get away with it because it looks so beautiful.
It looked great.
And I think they both look beautiful. And if you put them next to each other, you could see their difference. I was like, okay, that's, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's a good...
I
agree.
I love how, because in the first film, it was so big and vast already. And mm-hmm. we were learning dragons and their abilities. And now it's just... Dragons are integrated into this culture. We know them. Mm-hmm. We've accepted them. We have games with them, you know, the dragon racing. Mm-hmm. So it's like living in LA without...
So kind of like Quidditch?
In a way, but it's...
Inspiration.
It's an acceptable thing because everyone has a dragon now.
Oh, sure.
And, mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of like, if you didn't have a dragon, you were an outcast. I mean, what's wrong with you? That's like living in LA and not having a car.
Right.
So, you know, it's something that like everyone has now. And I loved how they build upon that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the different personalities that they added to the dragons.
Yeah. And again, it just expanded upon the world. Like we learn more about the universe. We mm-hmm. learn more about the world. I also find it very interesting that, you know, you can look at Hiccup a couple of ways. Number one, you know, we talk about he was searching for himself. Well, what's he doing? He's an explorer, always searching. He's searching for new lands. But I love the fact that he was an explorer, that he was looking for, instead mm-hmm. of playing the reindeer games or the dragon games,
mm-hmm.
you know, he was out exploring. He was trying to find new lands. He was trying to, and he had his map and how he would jot it down. And this was called Stinky Armpit Land.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the call, too. I think that in general, besides if you just take people's interpretation of Vikings,
right,
the fact that he didn't really embrace the you know, fight everything aspect, but the wandering to new places,
sure,
to finding new places, very yeah, much a Viking value.
Sure.
So they used that for him to really link onto his culture. I liked.
Yeah.
And I thought that, and I liked how it also was expanded by his mother, like the scene where they have his map.
Right.
And she just like blows it out of the water. Right.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. But again, and I think that that harkened back to, you know, the Hereditary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had a mother who, you know,
instincts,
was an explorer. She loved the world outside, you know, outside of the hometown. I forget what it's called.
Burke.
So, you know, and you see more of the bonding and the connection over there. So that's why I think, you know, with what they've done, I'm interested to see the next chapter, to see how the world expands and to see what new things I can learn and see. And, yeah.
I think that one thing that, just from reading interviews, it was like they love to put in lines that don't completely make sense and then use those for inspiration points.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, this is kind of prediction-oriented, but I don't know, so it can't be considered a spoiler. But it's like, they were still putting them in. Like, it was mentioned 3 times that Toothless might be the last of his kind.
Right.
It was mentioned, like, 3 times that him and Astrid are supposed to get married.
Right.
So, it's the repetition, the things that are left kind of open, that theme of love, which we haven't really fully conquered yet, I think will probably be a big play.
Yeah.
In the future, at least.
Yeah, you know, let's talk a little bit about the characters now. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of the voices coming back. Gerard Butler, Stoic, of course. Jay Baruchel back as Hiccup, America Ferrera. I loved how they did get the original cast members back, and then a little bit more.
Yeah.
I mean, Cate Blanchett playing Vaca, the mother.
Yeah, she was great.
Great choice. I think that they did some really good casting, and I was reading something that America Ferrera said, and she just was so thankful that they went outside of type for her voice, because she just really embraced the role, and it is, I think that her voice does fit the character, but it does go into casting where you have to think about all the components. Like, people have to be able to automatically contribute that what the character is just through sound, not through their looks. And sure. I think that each person does it really well. Like, Cate Blanchett was picked because they wanted her to both enable that regal, royal, commanding sound while also being able to be very vulnerable.
Yeah.
And that's a very hard dynamic, and I think she did do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think as an actress, she has that broad range to convey that emotion, even through voice. And I thought that was great. And also, Dean, the director, you know, confronted Cate Blanchett at the 2011 Academy Awards. Be like, I wrote this part specifically for you.
Yep.
And it was fortunate that Cate Blanchett's characters were, her sons were big fans of the first one, and so was she. So she was definitely on board.
Yeah.
What did you guys, how did you feel about Vaca and Stoic's song? Because that's an interesting component.
Their courting song.
Their courting song. Were you expecting it? Did it make you feel like you were going into a different movie?
I honestly, I wasn't expecting it because I don't know if that was an actual tradition in Norwegian tradition.
I looked up at, I mean, Vikings, there's not a lot of recorded history about Vikings, but they do say that music was a huge part of their everyday life. So it was used it was used in work. It was used in festivals. It was used in every day, all the time. So I think that that was kind of an accurate portrayal because it was such a vocal culture versus, like, writing things down.
Yeah.
To me, it was interesting because I know Gerard Butler as a singer. That's how I was introduced to him.
Phantom
the Opera. And so I was like, I was a little confused because I was like, oh, we're going to hear Gerard Butler sing. It's going to get really good. And I was like, this is more yell talking. And I was like, what an interesting choice. Like, that they had this great singer and they were just like, nope, this character does not sing.
I'm glad that they didn't go with that, though.
Because,
it would have taken the audience out because people who know him from Phantom of the Opera would expect this operatic voice, and that wasn't the case. And that really fit with his character, Stoic, a guy who you wouldn't really think would burst out in song like that. His name lives up to his reputation,
but,
stoic.
But I, even more so than that, too, this isn't a musical. Like, this isn't
a... It's not a Disney film.
Yeah, well, it's not... this isn't a musical, so had it gone to that level, that would have, like, really put the brakes on and put a halt to this, because it would have come out of nowhere, number one. We're not primed for it because there's been no music, so to speak, outside of score. And there's been, you know, and outside of, like, in the town of Burke, there might be some music and dancing and during the festival or whatnot. But it's not, characters aren't perpetuating the plot through music. Mm-hmm. So this one scene, if they're trying to make it look a little more traditional, like, it didn't bother me. I found it to be a touching moment. And I said, you know, but I still said, well, it's not a musical, but through music, through the courting, I could mm-hmm. see that this is within this world's history that mm-hmm. they did 20 plus years ago. So, and they're just redoing their vows, I guess, in a sense. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I think it was like they're making up for all the lost time that they could have had together. Yeah. And this was their one big moment that they could celebrate being a family together until we get to mm-hmm. Act 3, where, you know, the family literally separates and gets split apart. Mm-hmm. So I really didn't mind that they had this courting song. Mm-hmm. It was a nice calming down, slowing down moment from all the overwhelming dragons and whatnot. I was like, all right, family time. Let's enjoy this mm-hmm. before we go back out into the world.
And it was pulling the family together as well. You know, it was bringing the family back together after this absence. And it does it in a sweet way. And you buy into it. And once the courting scene, everybody is happy mm-hmm. family together again. And yeah, and you know, you were feeling, it felt good. You know, it was nice. And Hiccup was getting what he wanted. You know, he was getting his family, and he still had Toothless as part of his family, too.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the other characters. I mean, we had Drago, voiced by Daimon Hunsu.
I'll let you attempt that name.
Yeah, Daimon Hunsu. I mean, he's a great actor in and of himself, and I really liked how he brought his soft, guttural, really commanding voice to it, because this is his first voice animation for any project mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. he's ever done, and he thought it was a great experience. Did we like him as the Drago?
Yeah, I didn't even know it was Daimon Hunsu at all, and I thought he did a really good... He played off, what do we call it, his craziness. Mm-hmm. I thought he played off very well. Casting him, I thought, was a really, really good... Yeah, it was a good choice.
I thought that he did a really good job with the role. Just, like, his voice resonated really well with that character. It was a good match. His storyline, I completely bought that he was, you know, a little bit twisted and very angry.
Right.
I was a little interested in kind of the aspects of his history that they dove to spend a lot of time on and the ones they didn't. Because to me, they spent a really good amount of time with his whole entering into the Chamber of Chiefs with his dragon skin cloak, and it was like this big, huge ordeal, and I was just kind of confused, like, why that was... I thought that, for me, saying that very shortly, like, he killed all the chiefs without mercy is one thing, versus, like, they just sped over how he became, like, the ruler of this alpha. Mm. Like, they completely sped over, like, exactly how he lost his arm and how he lost his family. It was done in, like, two sentences. And I was like, wait, how did you get this army? Where have you been? How did you get that thing under your control?
How did you get to point B?
Well, exactly. I mean...
I was a little like, what?
Interesting, because as I was watching the movie, I sort of kind of looked at him as almost of a offshoot, an extension of like a Captain Ahab. You know, mm-hmm. he truly, you know, his white whale is the dragons. He was maimed by a dragon, much like Hiccup, and they made that parallel clear. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a twist, when he took his arm off. So you can understand his anger there. And his having control over what having control over what scares him mm-hmm. or what people fear, and inflicting that fear upon, you know, dragons that's what they do. They inflict fear, and I am going to control that fear and unleash it, you know. I'm going to build an army.
I'm going to control it before it controls me.
Yeah, and I'm going to unleash that fear in the world around me because I'm just, you know, crazy. Now, I only make that extension because Ahab lost his leg to the white whale, to Moby Dick, and his was vengeance. And in a sense, I looked at Drago's, his thing was out of vengeance. I mean, he was just a mean... But he was psycho. He was nuts. Mm-hmm. And he was unmoving, as you said
earlier. I guess he was almost just like, I would have been more interested to visually see, like, a flashback of him retaining his alpha or losing his arm and his family versus the stoic impression.
I don't know.
It was just an interesting... For me, like, that was the section they chose to focus on.
Well, I sort of took it, too, though. There was a scene in which he overcomes a dragon. And, again, the direct parallel is this is how Hiccup does Toothless along with his mom. You know, there's a love, there's a bond, there's a feel. His was pure, like, how do you beat a bad dog? His was... put the dog under the heel, like he stepped on its head, he took control. Like he became the alpha. And I just assume that in one way, shape, or form, he found the way to have the alpha submit.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, that was his way of control.
Through bad dog training.
And it reminded me of how Stoic treated Toothless in the first movie when he overcame him, and it was that, like, smush the ground, chain to a boat.
Yeah.
Like, you did see the parallels there.
How to bad train your dragon.
Exactly. And also, along with Jagger, we had his minion, Arryt, voiced by Kit Harington. And Sarah, you're a big Game of Thrones fan.
I didn't recognize his voice.
Neither did I.
I'll be honest, neither did I. I was like, what? I was like, wait, who did Kit play? Like, I literally, it's hard for me to even recall, like, his voice. Cause, like, they just didn't mash up in my head. I'm not saying he didn't do a good job. Like, I actually really like the character. I just didn't put the actor to it. So I was, like, really thrown back when I read that.
Shows he's a great actor and voice actor as well.
Well, yeah, I didn't realize it was him.
This was his first voice animation project.
Yeah, and I didn't realize it was him. And then I found this great thing because he was asked to do it. And he was originally asked because Harrington developed a Swedish accent for the character after talking with Dean. They said, so he did. He developed an accent for it. And then usual the case be, they clash with the studio because they felt that his accent and even inflection sounded too close to Hiccup, to Jay Burchell's voice. So he had to go back to the drawing board, and he was like, well, what if I then do two sides of my own English accent? He's like, I could do the well-spoken side of my parents in a more working-class London where he lives. So he opted for a version of the latter. And so hence that's how he came up with his. I didn't know it was him until, like I said, I was like, oh, well, hey, good for him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I thought his character was very interesting. I never thought that I could feel as much random subtleties from animated characters so much, because I put it in my head that him and Astrid kind of had a thing. Like, I don't know.
Oh, really? Oh, because I didn't see that at all.
Oh, no, I didn't.
I don't think it was actually there. I think like, it wasn't. I imposed that impression on them. And I was like, they've made no hint that these two have feelings for each other. But I literally felt that way. And I was like, that's something that very much happens in live action, where you see the chemistry of two actors and you're like, oh, I think they hate each other. Opposites attract. Yeah, you're like, I think they could have a thing. And I was imposing my own feelings on animated characters in this movie, and I was like, no, this is animation. They would have told me. They would have said something, but because the whole time, obviously, you have all
that's a lot.
Oh my gosh, I'm totally forgetting her name. The twin,
Refna and Tufnut.
Yeah. So you have her like pining for him, and I'm like, but he's really attracted to Astrid, and I'm like, that's not there. The drama is not in that movie, but in my opinion, it was.
I did.
That's fine.
I don't know. That's maybe funny. Yeah, it's just my underlying wanting some drama.
What did you have before you saw the movie?
No. It worked.
I did enjoy how they had that possibility of having that romance story with one of the twins, and how she had the feelings for Eric, and we're like, no, that's not good.
No.
And but it was comedic in that sense.
Yeah. And it was a good subplot to have kind of them still have character involvement versus just playing, you know, the backup or the friends. Like, they're not training anymore. They haven't really taken, they're not in leadership positions.
No.
So giving them something that kind of united them and added to the plot, I thought it was a smart little
And
twist.
Again, that character could have just been the typical henchman. I mean, that's what he was. That's what he is. He's a henchman to this Drago character, but to Hiccup's credit, you know, we do have at least one bad character change. Mm-hmm. We do have, you know,
the
where he convinces
characters.
Him. And Hiccup does, in fact, convince him about dragons. And it's proven when, I believe it's Toothless that saves him.
No, it wasn't Toothless. It's Astrid's dragon.
Dragon says, you know, saves him. And, you know, he's a nice addition to the cast going forward. He's a good, you know, because in a sense he could be the Han Solo-ish. He's the rogue. He's the, you know.
He has he's different than all of them. He has a different upbringing than all of them.
Right.
And as much as we've seen all of these, I'm going to call them trainees because that's what they were in the first film, say they're big and bad.
Right.
And, like, can do all the dragons. They never really any good. And he's kind of the first one who's come in and was actually arrogant for a reason.
Yeah.
Like, he is a good trapper. And so I thought that was a fun...
Sure.
To put someone else who is actually, in a way, skillful.
Yeah.
Back
and
in the mix.
I liked how they played the twin with that. And she was kind of like the voice for the audience. Be like, oh, I was rooting for you because you seemed like a cool guy. But now you're a mean guy.
Right.
And then it was that whole back and
That's
forth.
True.
And I loved how they played with that with the audience. And yeah, we were rooting for this bad guy, Eric, because you knew he was going to have that. He had that internal conflict.
Right. Yeah.
And he realized at the end, and he had that character switch too. And I thought that was really well done.
Yeah. I agree.
Totally. I also liked, you know, just the other fun characters. Of course, we had Craig Ferguson back as Gobber and, you know, being that companion along for the ride, running around.
He's the family member. He's almost, well, I don't want to call him drunk uncle. I don't want to give it that credit, but he's the lovable family member that, you know, is looking out for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's got the comedic moments and he's voiced perfectly by Craig Ferguson.
Absolutely. And then of course we had our two main, characters, you know, with Astrid and Hiccup and how their relationship has blossomed over the 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm surprised they didn't really go more romantically with them. Now we seem that they're at this point where they are content with each other. They're more comfortable. You mean, we saw Astrid making fun of Hiccup and, like, doing his imitations, which is actually the only scene that Jay and America Ferrera actually voiced together.
Uh-huh.
There's the one scene throughout the whole film that they actually did together.
Well, and that was those are funny scenes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the, I don't talk like that, and, you know, and Jay Bertolt too, he has a particular cadence in the way that he talks that is unique, and, you know, to lend it to an awkward teenager, 20-year-old, you know, it still works. I think the voice casting in that was great. We do have to talk about Gobber a little bit, but go.
Yeah, I was going to say, I love their voices for the characters. I think they match extremely well. The scene that you're bringing up where, you know, Hiccup's kind of, he's found a new land, Astro joins him, they have this conversation, I thought it was cute for the relationship. I thought this was the scene that you could really see that the animators were having a lot of fun with facial expression.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that it was the first point where, I mean, we might get into it. They did use some new technology or made facial expression easier. And there was a lot of it. And I felt like they were just like, okay, I can make them do this so easy. Let's make them have a lot. And I was like, a little too much, guys. I understand you're having fun. I don't need Astrid's face to move every half a second. Because literally, if you watch her as she's listening, there's no stillness in her voice. I was like, what are you doing? I was like, calm down. But
and also added to that, we had the two dragons in the back just playing like dogs and right. having fun. So yeah. it was a
that
lot
was
going
really cute, though.
It was a lot going on in that yeah. scene, which was again, absolutely. I think a testament to just the animators having fun.
Exactly. Yeah. They just went a little wild
like,
on that one.
Yay, we're back for a second one. Let's have fun with it.
Yeah, and you know, again, the animation in this movie, again, I don't know what else is coming out.
Let's get into the animation.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
So I know that this film, they had a regular 30 to 40 animators, but up until the last few months, the number would even increase to 50 just, you know, to complete mm-hmm. the film.
Sure.
But they used new technology
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and, animation software called Apollo, which immediately it helped with the hand-drawn animation, and it was like, this program allowed them to have the mix of hand-drawn animation, stop motion, and the possibility of just, like, editing on the computer all right. together, which mm-hmm. helped with the workflow.
Sure.
Yeah. And they had other technologies as well that did just make things, instead of having to actually, like, click and drag each movement, and more of was a... they had programs that just reflected, like, skin over muscle, how, like, the wind affects you... And things that made it go by quicker. And I think when things go by quicker, sometimes you add too much or more. But overall, 90% of the film was, I was like, breathtakingly beautiful. I think their flying and cloud work is amazing.
Yeah.
Lots
every time, like,
clouds.
The two scenes, like, the opening sequence of really Hiccup and Toothless, like, embracing, and we just fully accept that they are just the most amazing flight mm-hmm. pair. The separate gliding. The other scene where him and his mother are flying the dragons together and she
sure.
does all the gliding movement.
Oh, yeah. No, that was beautiful.
And with the reaction lands. Of the yeah. air coming up and how oh. they implied all that. It was yeah. consistently, it was gorgeous. So all of that I thought was extremely well. The only scene is the one that I pointed out was just Astrid and Hiccup, and I was just like, okay, maybe it's because we're not having as much going on that you were like, oh, we can play.
And again, I think that, you know, when you have somebody consulting like a Roger Deakins, and when you're, again, this is a little bit more than just converting to 3D. This is animating, knowing that you're going to be in 3D and choosing your environments or drawing the environment so they have the depth of scale that's necessary to make 3D flush and to make it look beautiful. And going back to the Sanctuary of Dragons, I mean, there was a very beautiful land. Even the Alpha's crystal mm-hmm. ice color, like, you know, yeah. that added depth and color palette. And when you're directing for something like that, again, it goes back, you hire experienced people to help you to make it look this way. So from a cinematography level, mm-hmm. you know, it's just like the first one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It looked beautiful and it creates a world. And again, I'll going back to Avatar, mm-hmm. James Cameron knew he was going to film in 3D and he wanted to create a world that we've never seen before. Mm-hmm. And How to Train Your Dragon 2 here has created a universe, and they continue to push the envelope, but they don't do it in a exploitive kind of a way. It's not like, hey, we're making a 3D movie because we want the extra mm-hmm. cash. It's like, no, we're going to make a 3D movie and we're going to make it look good. We
yeah.
want it to look good.
And you
good.
Can see it
to
me.
Themselves.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's like the love they have for the... Just the scenes and the environments they create is so beautiful. And to me, you can see that especially as they scroll through the artwork at the end credits.
Oh, yeah.
Where you get, like, what they were looking for each scene. And I'm like, and they accomplish all that. And I literally would hang that artwork on my walls.
Yeah, it's beautiful artwork.
Beautiful.
It wouldn't great. Surprise me if there was a How to Train Your Dragon 2 artwork, mm-hmm. you know, like coffee table kind of a book.
Exactly, because it's
oh,
beautiful.
Absolutely. I would love yeah. that. I mean, yeah. and... Again, going off of they just topped themselves and made it even more epic. Their types of worlds and made it more mm-hmm. grand. That this film actually used 700 million digital files, utilizing more than 400 terabytes of data, which is the most of any DreamWorks animation production to date.
I got that in my iPhone.
Yeah. No,
I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, no, it is.
And well, the hours of rendering that they spent, over 90 million hours of rendering.
But let's talk about something. I mean, you know, that all comes with a cost. I mean, the production budget alone was $145 million. That's for an animated movie. But then when you talk about the total budget, including hard drives and advertising, you know, you're talking $210 million. When people make a live action movie at $210 million, you sort of kind of go, whoa, that's expensive. This is an animated movie.
So it's not like you're paying for locations and people. Yeah.
You're paying for the technical aspects. Yeah.
So, you know, it comes at the cost. And will they make it up? You know, hopefully so. I mean, they have slated a third, so.
It's funny because, like, do you look at it, like, from a money perspective, does it, all that we've said, this is a standalone movie. Mm-hmm. But part of me wants to just be like, but you got 500 million from the first one. Like, it is worth it for the fans. You've got another one coming out. I think this becomes lasting. I think you do get products out of it. I think you do get people who are going to buy the whole trilogy, and like a lot of money will come from that in the end. Sure. And yeah, maybe the second one didn't make as much money. I don't think that makes it a waste. Yeah. Yet. Or not worth it, because I think the first one kind of earned that potential and shows that there's going to be a growth. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, unfortunately, just from a business side, aspect side of it, unfortunately, the movie didn't necessarily, in its opening weekend, didn't live up to what had been expected. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's history to show that similar movies like A Monsters University, also a sequel, opened up around the same time period and did, like, you know, within the high 60s or so. And this one, which had very good will going towards it because of the first movie, you know, was expected. And not only that, I mean, there was a lot going for Dragon. Goodwill because they made a really good first movie, which $500 million worldwide. I don't know what the home entertainment value of it was.
Really? Okay. Good.
So then add to that, this is the first, and it's the first and really only family animated movie to come out this summer. It has no competition from a Disney and or Pixar movie.
Maleficent is out.
It's not an animated movie.
But it's not.
It's not an animated movie. It's the only one of its sort right now. And you know, I know later we're going to get a Planes 2 sequel.
We get the one with the aliens.
Right, later on down. But for summer, this was the first one out. So they had expected, you know, more families to come out. I don't know why. It's tough because there's been a lot of writing on it this past week. Could it have been the marketing? Did they not emphasize more laughs in the marketing? I don't know. And I don't have an answer myself. Nice. I expected it to be mid high 60s, maybe 72.
I thought it was going to be number one. I was completely standing behind that.
I thought so too. And also, I mean, I don't like it when numbers bog down a really great film, because this was a great film. It had good writing, good animation, all that. And then to be just have it tainted by numbers that didn't start off as well as it should have, or what people were expecting it to be, shouldn't take away from the film.
No, it doesn't. But I think in this case, because sometimes you talk about numbers of a movie before it's released. Mm-hmm. That to me can be somewhat silly. But when expectations are sort of high, and who brings up those expectations? Well, I think from an audience standpoint, from my standpoint, you know, someone who looks at numbers a lot, who does a lot of, you know, trying to analyze. And again, it was just like, there's always, coming from the studio side of things, there's always the finger pointing that's going on. Mm-hmm. There's always the backstab politics now. And who's well, you didn't do this right, or you didn't market it right, or you didn't do this. And I'm just trying to figure out, like, everybody seemed to do their jobs. I thought the marketing was fine. They didn't make it look like a Kung Fu Panda 2 kind of a movie or anything. I don't know if they could have showcased more laughs, but no,
I loved how the very first trailer, teaser, anything of How to Train Your Dragon 2 that I saw was just the flying flying scene.
I thought it was
when they were in the clouds. And that's all I needed because it got me excited. And I'm like, they're making a second one. It looks awesome. They're flying side by side now. This is even better than the first one.
Sure.
I think that the only way I can look at it or make assumptions about it is like how I view the people in my life are going or not going. And I think that as I talk to people, I have a lot of friends who want to see it. And like, this is the first movie they're going to see. And I have family that's, you know, and just graduating high school, and it's not quite summer yet. A lot of people are in finals. A lot of people are on their last week of school. So I'm thinking maybe this will pick up in the next 2 weeks as people do get on the summer vacation, as that all gets underway. And that's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah, and also this film opened up with the same week as 22 Jump Street, and we had it had a competition in that way, and that was also
completely different audience.
I know, but that was also a sequel too. Yeah. And so people might want to go to that film because that movie got a lot of recognition for being really funny. That was a word of mouth. People wanted to see that.
Yeah, my only argument about that is that it's apples to oranges. I mean, they're two completely different audiences.
But and I'm saying it did have competition too.
Yeah, to an extent. There was no kids. There was no family. 22 Jump Street is not a family movie.
No, it's not.
But, you know, here's the thing too. When you look at both movies that we talk about, both movies have been received well by the press. I think 22 Jump Street is in the high 80s on Rotten Tomatoes. How to Train Your Dragon 2, 94%. And a cinema score of A. So that's meaning whoever, you know, the 50 million, the 49, 47 million that it brought in, people who see How to Train Your Dragon 2 are really liking it. So much like, you know, going both 22 Jump Street and How to Train Your Dragon 2 are going into their second weekends, the competition is sort of kind of, there's nothing necessarily vying for their business, you know, although I do think there will be another number one movie going into this weekend when we come in on Monday. I think that How to Train Your Dragon 2 could have a solid hold only because of the goodwill that it has already garnered and from the other families who may talk to other families going, yeah, my son wants to see it, and who knows why they couldn't go out.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's, you know, playing box office derby is just one of those things, and agree with you. You make a solid point. For anybody who hasn't seen this movie, you know, don't let the numbers bog you down. What people talk about as being disappointed, because sometimes they look, you know, somebody who hasn't seen it, they can hear in the news or they're in their car, and they're not really fully paying attention, and they hear disappointing at the box office this weekend or disappointing showing this weekend, and they're not listening to clearly find out, well, that just means that it didn't
get the money.
It doesn't mean that it's a bad movie. And this, I think we all agree, is a very good movie.
Completely.
I agree. And this movie opened up on Father's Day weekend too.
Which should have sort of kind of helped.
Yeah.
You
think it would help. But like, again, we had another male oriented film that came out as well with 22.
Yeah.
So, and like, I mean, it was a little before, but like my family, I know my stepdad wanted to see Edge of Tomorrow. That was his, like, Father's
and
Day.
And Edge of Tomorrow is doing good too. I mean, it started off with slow numbers, but then it built. So I think the exact same thing will happen with this film, that it might not have had the best expected start, but I think with time duration, it will get to that point.
Yeah, I mean, fingers crossed. Again, I just, you know, looking at what we have in the, you know, this weekend, maybe not so much. You know, then we have, this little movie called Transformers, which is probably going to be
just a little movie.
Yeah, it's probably going to be the biggest opening this summer. And it's interesting because, again, starting in May, there were articles that had said, hey, you know, there's a very good, strong possibility that How to Train Your Dragon 2 could potentially be the big number one movie of the summer. And, you know, it's tough. And again, I don't want to, you know, we're talking numbers. Sometimes it's tough to sort of climb out of the hole, albeit it's not a very deep hole. But it's sort of kind of a hole, you know, it's 10 million less or so, 10 to 15 million less. And so you got to make that up. And when you have some other big movies and then some other kids movies like a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you're hoping that your goodwill on this will, you're hoping that there's going to be some longevity throughout the weeks ahead.
Absolutely.
But it will have some strong competition.
And longevity. Speaking of longevity, they kept saying that this is part two of a trilogy. So
sure.
We're pretty much expecting a third one. And mm-hmm. as we said, this was a very standalone film.
Mm-hmm.
I think where they're going to pick up is now Hiccup is in that chief position and he's going to still go out and be going on his adventures, but like find even a bigger conflict to deal with and how he handles it as chief instead of someone trying to.
We're meeting another Night Fury. That's yeah. my theory.
Well, I think
well there's
so
that, but let me ask you this too. I mean, because let's just say it takes another 3 to 4 years.
What if we met a female Night Fury for a Hiccup?
You mean for Toothless?
I mean, yeah, for Toothless.
No, I'd rather the Hiccup thing. I think that would yeah. be a love triangle that I'd be but, down yeah. for.
a female Night Fury for Toothless. I think that would be interesting.
Yeah, could be. Well, what if the movie? So the sequel picks up, or the third in the trilogy picks up, and what if when we open up, Hiccup and what's her name?
Astrid
are
getting
like
married.
Or if they're already married. Like, maybe they're in the first year of their marriage. Maybe they're still in the honeymoon period. Who knows? Yeah,
I think that I'm wondering... Oh, sorry, Marissa. I just
oh, no,
cut you off. I think that it'll be interesting if we do address the problem of do dragons stick around or do they disappear? Like...
Well, it's funny enough because you, the stories, you know, the books of How to Train Your Dragon written by Cressida Cowell, she has a series out, and one of the first lines in the book was like, back in this time when dragons existed, so we started off with the story that dragons used to exist, but they don't exist anymore. So what if they did go into that type
exactly,
of storyline?
So.
I mean... that'd be upsetting.
Where did they go?
I mean, exactly what happened? Maybe they're extinct. Mm-hmm. Or they're on the brink of extinction. I think mm-hmm. that'd be an interesting
and I think,
story to play with.
Especially because what we've seen, they mentioned in this film, one of the ominous lines was, how many alphas are there? And they mentioned, like, 5. And if we have one that's injured and one that just died, like, how is that affecting the dragon population? Like, they were the, what, they said they were the originals of the species?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So killing them might have a very big impact.
Absolutely, because,
sure.
you know, you killed the top one, everything underneath it is bound to fall as well.
Yeah, and the injured one can't be an alpha anymore because he's been hobbled to an extent. But we have Hiccup, mm-hmm. and if we're going under the assumption that there are, what, 2 more alphas somewhere out in this universe, in this world?
2 or 3.
Right. Well, but Hiccup's one. So,
or Toothless.
Toothless is one.
Well, maybe the be a start of another new breed.
Who knows?
Maybe.
Another new generation of alphas.
Yeah.
Which would be another cool
yeah.
story. And also the director, Dean, he said because it does take 3 to 4 years to create an full animation
Absolutely.
Movie
yeah.
that they need to start now. And he said that there are 2 versions that he has in his head that where they would pick up the third one. Would it immediately pick up where they left off, or the second version, like, it might be a little farther off, down
right.
maybe mm-hmm. another 5 years, mm-hmm. another half decade to
right.
pick it up. So it could really be anywhere.
Well, Dean the Blois does say, when asked, did you envision this as part of a trilogy? We're trying to make the best movie we could make. I don't think any of us had a grand plan in mind. But when we were talked to coming up with ideas for a second one, there were threads in the first one that hadn't been completely explained. Like, what happened to Hiccup's mother, which we talked about. Mm-hmm. Look at that. Look, see how on we are? We're pretty on. And what was that Red Death, the top of the chain in terms of dragon hierarchy? Or is there another dragon beyond that? There were certain things that we could play with, so it very naturally opened up for us. My only pitch back was that it be a trilogy instead of just a random next sequel, so that it could really feel like it was a second act of a 3-act story.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll, you know, we'll see. Listen, he's done a good job thus far. He did make a very good sequel that's worthy of the original. He expanded the universe. He did what a very good sequel should do. Expand upon the universe, try to be and live up to the first one. Don't disrespect your audience or
mm-hmm.
the goodwill that your first one garnered.
Mm-hmm.
Be smart about it. Move your characters forward. And then, you know, we'll see what happens when the third one comes out.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, you had two
I'm
movies.
Looking forward to it.
Right. And both movies have gotten very good reviews.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm looking forward to it as well.
Yeah. And I just want to quickly talk about the music. I mean, we had John Powell back as the composer for this one, and I loved how he built upon his already set scores, but made it more grand.
He did exactly what they did with the scope of the film to the music, which is why it reflected really well. You still get, you can recall the same music. You can feel, you hear the same tunes. You pick up off the same instruments. To me, there was a lot more vocal work in this one. I know that they did use like a 100-person choir and like a 120-person orchestra, so they did have a lot of people going into this recording session. But to me, that was interesting. I do like that they use kind of folk instruments throughout the score. I think it really embraces that culture and adds like an element of fantasy and whimsy, and with the flutes and everything, you do get that playfulness that surrounds this film.
And also using the same instruments but in different ways, because especially the bagpipes for one. John Powell mentioned that in the first film he used bagpipes for a celebratory type of situations and stuff.
Sure.
And it was more happy. And then he said in this, the second one, that he used it in a more medieval way, more threatening, that he used it as like warnings, signals.
Sure.
When we saw the big alpha, like people were blowing the horn. So it was more a darker use of bagpipes.
And he had to, he also had to parallel the themes of this movie. You know, he goes on to say, because, you know, this is a, our characters are more mature this time when we're seeing them again for the second time. 20 years old. That's a lot different than 20 is a lot different from being 15 or 16. And he had to make his music mature as well, with the character, so that it parallels, plays better. You know, and at the same time, he couldn't make it so grand. You know, he says, he goes, look, this is a mature film. He goes, however, it can't be Lord of the Rings. He goes, I can't be that, you know, that grand. And, but yeah, he did. He, you know, he wanted to, match the times. And like you said, the bagpipes and his big orchestra. And it sounds, again, the world that they create. Again, this is a very collaborative effort, and the music only adds to that world. It brings a new palette of color, so to speak, when you watch this movie. The music score, I thought, was very, very good.
Yeah, so what are we hoping for first season? I'm talk too much television. For the
there
third
are kind
film.
Of seasons of this. You can find those.
In season they three, I guess you can say.
No, but they made other episodes outside of these films.
They did. They made that TV series on, I believe it's Cartoon Network. And so even Jay Baruchel and America Ferrera, they never really left these characters.
No.
They were always. No. It's been part of them for the last 4 or 5 years now, which I think is great. You can still have the understanding of how, in that sense, you know how your character has grown over the years.
Right.
And we don't. And they can bring that to the acting side.
Sure.
I want to see in the third one, like, a little bit more about the dragons and their tricks. Like, how Vaka knew that there was a backspine with, and knew how to tell the age of Toothless. Just those little things that I want to learn more about the dragons and their personalities and what makes them amazing.
You want to expand the dragon world even more.
I do.
I can totally see that.
Because we know that there are different levels, but now what are, like, how different apart are they?
Right.
Exactly. I agree. I think it's fascinating, especially because they have, I mean, it's been talked about a lot around this movie that, you know, dragons are, like, the thing right now.
Yeah.
But one thing How to Train Your Dragon does have differently is that it is not just one particular, like, species that varies just by, like, color. Like, I'm a huge Game of Thrones fan. We've watched all these ones. And typically, the dragons look very similar. They all, like, spurt fire or whatnot. And they are just like, oh, that one's red, that one's green, that one's black. They're different sizes. But this series franchise really embraces that, no, they're like fish. Like, there are so many different types.
Yeah, there's individuality upon them.
There's personality to them.
Absolutely.
So I think that it's great fun to point out that difference and show everything that they can do.
Examples of personality. The production designer, Pierre Olivier Vincent, he mentioned that, you know, what would you do if you put a bulldog and a dragon together? You would get a grand cul. So just those little things. I want to expand more details.
I'm just looking, much like this sequel, you know, the third movie.
Character.
I just, again, take me to the next step. Like, blow up the world a little bit more for me. Not just the dragons, but this Viking world.
More fun inventions.
I want to see.
From Hiccup.
I want to see where Hiccup, you know, where he lands or doesn't land. And I just want an expansion of the entire world. It doesn't, you know.
Not just Burke as much, maybe.
Not just Burke, but I just want to see an expansion of, you know, perhaps we will learn. I mean, you guys came up with some great theories regarding Toothless, and maybe there is a female Night Fury dragon out there. Who knows? But also within the, maybe there are other Viking tribes out there as well. I don't know, but it's just expanding the universe. Much like you did in this one, you opened up my eyes a little bit more from the first one. You expanded upon that, and I came away going, hey, that was great. I learned a little bit more about this, and I want to see character expansion as well. I want to see, you know, perhaps we'll see how is Hiccup dealing with his responsibility, and is it hindering him from being, you know, the explorer, the adventurer that he loves to be, or maybe he starts to become more like his dad, and then he's like, got to break out into the world, because that's, you got to find a balance. And when you're in your mid 20s going into 30s, that's what that's about. It's about trying to find that balance. Can I be the person that I was while having these new responsibilities? So, you know.
Yeah, I want to see how Hiccup, you know, uses his innovations and inventions to better his community of Burke, and how to help with the dragons too. And also, just another little fun fact, the Dean himself, that he, when growing up, he liked tinkering with objects and, you know, playing with that, and so kind of added that to Hiccup's character, always improving on something and having those fun creative inventions.
Sure.
So I think that's it for this film.
There's a couple of things. There's one thing I think we have to talk about because it has been in the press. But I also want to go back to the composer, because I think, like, he had a great story about, you know, usually, you know, you're composing a movie and whatnot, and you can get dailies to look at, but you can get actual type of footage or whatnot. Or in some cases, your movie's pretty much edited and done and ready to go. And you can, this movie, it's an animated, he can only go off storyboards. And he's like going, storyboards can change. I just find it, that's a fascinating challenge for a composer, to score a movie. And when seeing either this movie or the first movie at Cannes, he's like, God, I wish I had seen all this when I was able to sit down. It would have been so much easier to do. So I always found that funny. The one thing that that I think need talk about too, because it has been brought up, is Gobber. In some articles, it has been brought up that this is the first movie in which an animated character has quote unquote come out of the closet. And this is all because of, Craig Ferguson's line in the movie when husband and wife were arguing, and then Gobber's character says, "This is why I didn't get married." Well, that and another reason, and it's just a throwaway line, and somehow
easily overlooked.
Yeah, it was easily overlooked,
but it wasn't easily overlooked because it was very, like.
Well, here's what happened, and this is where I find that the story gets very interesting. This is why I never get that line, and one more reason was an ad-lib line from Ferguson. His line was, "See, this is why I never get married." Somehow this got blown up because when he was in his voicing section, he says, "Oh, and one more reason." After that, he said, "Yep, that's right." And he didn't say this as working, and he didn't say this as an overvoice. He just said it. They said, "Cut, okay, it's a take." And he goes, "Oh, that's right, Gobber's coming out." And for some reason, people really jumped on this to say, "Oh, we have a gay character." And like, "Ooh," and then it's been written like in various things about what happened to that scene where he comes out of the closet, and the director, Dean, who is openly gay, came out and I never had a scene where anybody came out of the closet. It's sort of kind of funny how this has morphed into that, only because, I mean, like, when I heard the line, I didn't
see too much of it.
No, I mean, that and one other reason, you know, who knows what that other reason is, but it's just funny how this gets out. And this gets out as, like, this is the first animated cartoon character that's coming out of a closet. And it's like, wow, are we starved for something like this? I mean, it was just it was an ad-lib line. Mm-hmm. It wasn't even printed in the script. And he just happened to say something, matter of, you know, as he's a comedian. And he's like, that's it. Gobber's coming out of the closet, you know? And somehow that just got blown up into this thing. And did you see it as anything else other than you did?
Yeah, completely. I mean, because...
But how do you know what... And one more reason.
I mean, I wasn't positive, but I felt like it was, that's what it was hinting, implying. I mean,
I didn't look at it that way until I found it after.
I mean, I didn't really think anything of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was literally in the caught of the moment. We're focusing on another relationship instead of his.
Like, that's right. Why it did stick out to me, because if we were so focused on one thing, and then he had one line, and there was like a poignant pause, and then there was a second line, and I was like, it did pull me out of their relationship and focus on him, which made me think, oh, what does that mean?
He could fart a lot and he can't find a wife, or maybe he's not. I don't know. I mean,
I don't know. I guess it was just a weird thing,
a lot of people just gravitated towards that. Interesting.
I didn't think
I watched too much Game of Thrones and he was a eunuch, but I mean, I don't know.
Maybe.
I mean, he is, you know, missing a lot of parts.
But it's
Disney, so I figured it wasn't that.
In my audience that I was watching it with, everyone laughed at the line, this is why I never got married, and I think I might have just probably missed the second line, because that, reading that, became a surprise to me. I was like, I didn't even see it or recognize it when I was watching it. So I think it's just one of those situations where they're trying to blow it up. Man, it's really nothing.
When there's nothing there. But Dean goes on to say...
But there's nothing wrong with that either. So.
I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that. It's just, it's an interesting thing to harp on when it was an ad-lib line. So it wasn't meant originally to be that serious to begin with.
But they kept it in.
Yeah, but many ad-libs, you know, get kept in. Now Dean says, oh, that's it. Maybe he should. And so it was Dean's decision, not mine. I just threw in an ad-lib line in. But Jerry, when he saw the film, thought it wasn't that I was gay, that the reason I hadn't gotten married because I'd lost my junk. It got cut off in a dragon fight, which tells you more about his mind than it does about anything else going on.
I guess I'm similar.
There you go.
Because these were my options that I was thinking.
So it's just interesting to find controversy where there is none.
Yeah.
You know?
So. I agree. But overall, that doesn't really change anything in the film.
No.
I loved it.
It doesn't change anything.
It was fun. I'm going to have my own kids watch this movie and love it. And when, you know, they grow up. I mean, it's a great franchise to definitely get a part of, especially coming off of Toy Story, going into How to Train Your Dragon. It's something that anyone can look forward to.
Yeah, and I really think it, in some ways, it lives up to certain Pixar standards of storytelling. It hits them. I think it's I thought it was very well conceived and brought to life.
Yep. Completely. And all right, so where can everyone follow you to keep talking about films and everything, Dimitri?
Right here. You know, put in your comments, please. I write back. I pay attention. I really do. And thank you to the gentleman, Maleficent. Somebody recommended another Elle Fanning movie. I'm going to try to watch that this weekend, but I'm right here.
Yep.
So.
And Sarah, we can find
I'm here as well, or you can find me on our AfterBuzz TV.
Yep. You can follow myself on AfterBuzz TV as well. You can follow all of us here at Anatomy of a Movie on Twitter at Movie Anatomy. On our website, check out our awesome schedule, anatomyofamovie.com. We have fun summer blockbusters still down the pipeline to talk about. Thank you all for listening. I hope you sure enjoyed this one, and we will see you for our next dissection.
Good being back with you folks.
Yes.
A lot of fun.
We're like Team Hiccup, red and black.
Team
Hiccup. There you go.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.